Uh-oh, is it going to work? Here it is, okay. House Committee on Revenue for March 29, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, as indicated to yesterday at our short meeting, I am carrying over House Bill 2270 and House Bill 2466 to our meeting tomorrow. Representative Holvey, who's very much involved in those in that issue, is not available today because he's chairing another committee today. So those two bills are being carried over till tomorrow, 2270, 2466. And which bill are you here on?
251.
So we'll, are we ready? Yeah, we are. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 251. And we have a member of that august body with us today.
It's my senator, Mr. Chair.
Yours, Representative Senator. I stand corrected.
So we are so excited here to talk
just,
about this.
Just a moment. We'll let Christine introduce the bill, and then we'll be happy to hear from the Senate.
Perfect.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 251 would decrease the threshold by which a lottery prize payment would be subject to withholding up front. And the limit's currently $5,000, and it would change it to $1,500. There is a minimal fiscal impact to the measure, and also there is estimated to be a revenue impact because of improved compliance with the existing tax statute related to these winnings. And so the revenue impact is positive $2.44 million in the 17-19 biennium, and in a full biennium, it is $3.26 million. So that would be for 2019-21.
Wonderful. Thank you. Senator, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to hear Senate Bill 251 today. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21, Southeast Portland. Senate Bill 251 lowers the prize amount that is subject to automatic tax withholding from $5,000 to $1,500. If this automatic prize withholding amount had been lowered during fiscal year 2016, it would have impacted 23,470 total prizes for a total prize amount of $50,871,903. The 8% tax would have amounted to $4,871,752, which means an additional $1.63 million per year. Department of Revenue learned from information collected in 2010 that approximately 40% of winners under the $5,000 threshold did not report the prize on their taxes. In other words, they were non-compliant with their reporting obligations. The $1,500 amount was chosen to ensure an absorbable fiscal impact for the agency, the Oregon Lottery, and will have a significant positive impact on the Department of Revenue's ability to obtain the taxes owed on lower lottery prizes efficiently, as fewer taxes on lottery prizes will need to be collected through enforcement measures. The Department of Revenue gathered various input from key agencies and individuals, including the Oregon Lottery. Deanna Mack is here from the Department of Revenue, as well as Barry Pack, the director of the Oregon Lottery, who can provide more specifics on the bill. You will have the revenue and fiscal impacts that came out from the Senate committee. You also have the revenue and fiscal impacts from the Senate committee. So thank you to everyone on the committee and Chair Barnhart, and happy, of course, to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Taylor. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the bill. Where did the 8% come from?
The 8% is that's what the tax – what is the amount?
Right. Follow-up. The assumption is there's a withholding of that amount of tax, but I'm just curious – Many of the folks who gamble are really low income, probably never file a tax return. I mean, all kinds of reasons why they might not be in that area of tax. So I'm just curious why the 8%, not let's say 6%, some lower amount.
Christine, thoughts on that question?
Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Benz, I think that it's probably the average amount of tax that ends up being.
Yeah, there's that number is from, they did an analysis here. I'll have Deanna Mack answer so she can use all the right terminology.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And to answer Representative Benz's question, the current statute has an 8% threshold, and it is based on average effective tax rate for most Oregonians. It's, I believe, in our statistics, I haven't looked at it lately, but I believe it's somewhere around 7.4-7.6%. It varies. And so that's the average number, and we round up on that. And we do that for payroll withholding assessments as well. It's the number that we choose because it's aligned with our statistics on effective rates.
Yeah, please.
If I recall correctly, we were looking at the income when we heard from the lottery folks. We looked at the income of those who gamble the most, and it looked to me as though a substantial, they try to say that it's spread evenly over all demographics, but that's not correct. It looked to me as though there was a heavy weighting toward the lower end of the income scale. So I'm just wondering if this is, if we've done the proper measurement in determining the 8%, because I don't think it's safe to say that the average person playing, that the person who gambles is necessarily the average over going in. I'm willing to be proved wrong.
Is Barry back here? Why don't you come up? We'll have everybody at the podium at the witness table at once, and that might be a question for you. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, sorry, for the record, Barry Pack, Director of the Oregon Lottery. Representative Vance, to your point, I think you're referring to the presentation I gave to this committee at the start of the session where we have some analysis on the demographics of our video lottery players. The statement we made was, generally speaking, the demographics align with that of Oregonians. There is a statistically significant difference between those making less than $40,000 a year than the rest of the income. But when you look at gender, age, and those other demographics as well, it spreads out across the population. So to your point, the average player may be more likely to be earning lower than $40,000. I will leave the tax amount question to the Department of Revenue.
Is that helpful? Or maybe responsive is a better
question. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Yeah.
Correct.
And Mr. Chair, please. Representative Vance, the 8%, if they file a return and they have excess withholding, it is just withholding. They'll get it back if it doesn't reflect their actual tax liability. They'll be able to get that money back upon filing a return.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You're right. Well, of course, many don't file returns. Just taking a wild guess. And I'm just saying. But I just want to make sure that number is as close to being right for what they would pay if they filed a return. That's all I'm asking. So that we have something that we can point at and say that's about right.
Senator Taylor.
Representative Vance, a couple of things. One, in Oregon, we do not have what are called player ID cards, for example, which is what they have at many of the big casinos in Las Vegas, et cetera. So we don't track the lottery doesn't know. There's a limit on how much they know about individuals. In addition, and we can have Mr. Pack talk in more detail about the way that this tax is collected is because people have to go and collect their winnings. And so at that moment, the tax is taken.
Follow up. Yes, please. Uh-huh.
So what happens when someone wins $1,600 or $1,500 now? Do they have to go, do they leave the machine and go somewhere else to get the money? There's no way to get that money at that moment, even with the tax taken out. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that's correct. For video lottery prizes over $1,200, the player has to come to either the headquarters here in Salem or our prize validation center in Wilsonville to be paid. Anything less than that can get paid by the retailer. For traditional product sales of $600 or less of winning, so if you're a scratch ticket, you win $50, you can get that at the local retailer. But anything over $600, you have to come in, and we verify and then make the payment. And that's also then the opportunity for us to report taxes federally to the IRS and to confirm whether or not there's any outstanding child support or overpayment of public assistance benefits, which then also get deducted at the time of prize payment.
Okay. You've been answering questions, but you also signed up as witnesses. I don't know if you had other things you wanted to say.
Mr. Chair, we just wanted to let you know that we are able to do this. This is something that taxpayers already currently have to go into the lottery to collect the prize payment. We already have a system in place for prize payments of $5,000 or greater, so it's literally just a change in a table from $5,000 to $1,500. And I believe Senator Taylor said the number of increased number of people who would be eligible for withholding on those accounts. We've worked with the lottery, and we're here to just let you know that we have worked with Senator Taylor, and we can administer this program and would support it.
Okay. So from the technical point of view, the bill's ready.
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. I would echo what Deanna said, but also then just to say that the $1,500 was not just a number picked out of the air, that it aligns with our federal reporting requirements of $1,200 above, but more importantly, it aligns with the games themselves. So the prize payouts are governed by the games, not by a terminal. And so in order to be able to withhold taxes at a lower rate, we'd have to go in and reprogram all of the games, and that's proprietary software owned by third-party manufacturers. So that's where a significant expense would come in. At this level, it's, as Deanna said, it's simply a change in a table in existing processes and procedures, and can be something we can do and absorb with our existing resources.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, I'm going to avoid the desire to editorially comment upon on what you just said. So going to the 5,000, why was it 5,000 and not 1,500 to begin with? Must have been a reason.
Chair Barnhart, I don't know the direct answer to that, Representative Vance. However, I know from secondhand information that this has been attempted in years past. Years and years ago, folks have said that we should be. Taxes are owed to the state when people pay and win at the lottery. 40% apparently are not paying. We have a problem here where people are not, you know, self-disclosing and are not paying. And so this is an opportunity to get money that is rightfully owed to the state. And it is, again, secondhand information, but my understanding is that this has been attempted in the past and did not was not successful.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how the 5,000 was originally set. We can look into it and see if I can track down some history for you.
Mr. Chair, again, I'm not going to object to this bill. I'm going to support the bill. It's just been my experience in watching the folks that decide to engage in this unfortunate method of taxation, because that's what this is, taxation on those who are mathematically challenged. All that's really happening here is we take the tax out, they go back, they gamble again with less. It's just the most amazing circular process. So I'm going to support the bill.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 251 and open a work session on Senate Bill 251. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I would simply note that I agree with you, Representative Benz, about the process and the issues. I know when the measure came before the voters a long time ago now, I voted no, and I would vote no again. But what we're faced with today, as of course you know very well, is the tax compliance bill. And if we were on a different issue, I might vote differently, but I agree with you. Anything else? Any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion is carried. Who would like to carry this bill on the floor?
Let the vice chair do it.
Representative Nose will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 251 open a public hearing on... I should open these separately, shouldn't I? Yes, on House Bill 3291, please. Who's presenting on that one? Paul?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3291 is House Bill 3291 directs the Department of Administrative Services to prepare a biennial budget stress test in which there would be an estimate of the fiscal effects of a hypothetical negative economic conditions They would work in cooperation with the Legislative Fiscal Office and Legislative Revenue Office. I'll say that we've done, the Office of Income Analysis has done a partial analysis, and you probably recall this in some of their presentations, where they've looked at alternative forecast scenarios and what that might mean for general fund revenue. So we've done a little bit of that in the past, but we haven't done anything formally and haven't done any coordinated look at both sides of the budget.
Great. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I had the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Umatilla County and Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and Wasco County, Port of Umatilla, Port of Morrow, Port of Arlington, Biggs Junction, and the Port of the Dalles. And so it's my pleasure to be here. I want to take you back 18 years, back to 2001. I was a freshman in the legislature. Republicans controlled the House and Republicans controlled the Senate. We had a governor by the name of Governor Kitzhaber. And at that point in time when I came in, the economy was doing relatively well. We were trying to balance the budget on what we thought were going to be increasing revenues. But all the while, and I remember this as a freshman, we had this gentleman from the Legislative Revenue Office who said, be careful. There's just some indicators out there that just aren't right, and the economy of Oregon could begin to turn down. And Chair Barnhart, you were there with me in that session. And if you'll remember, we were in a term-limited environment, which meant you had really inexperienced legislators who were doing the very best they could. And both legislative revenue professionals and legislative fiscal professionals kept warning the legislative leadership at the time, be cautious. But it was ignored. It was ignored. And so what I've thought about that over the last 16, 17 years, and what House Bill 3291 does is it would formalize the counsel we regularly receive from the legislative revenue staff and the legislative fiscal staff and the governor's Department of Administrative Services. And effectively what it would do is create a stress test where all 90 members of the legislature would be able to receive a professional summary of what would occur should a mild recession and a severe economic recession occur. Colleagues, I want each and every one of you to know I'm introducing this in a bipartisan manner. It really doesn't matter who's in control. Oregon's economy is subject to ups and downs, and because of our heavy reliance on the income tax, our ability to balance the budget becomes very, very challenging. Now, I want you to know the Department of Administrative Services and the Legislative Revenue Office and Legislative Fiscal Office already do much of this work. What I'm hoping to do is bring it all together collectively so all 90 members of the legislature have an opportunity to see the same information. I feel blessed serving on both the Revenue Committee and as Vice Co-Chair that much of this information is available to me. But I think I'm an anomaly, and not all members in both chambers have access to this. Want to just very briefly share with you that in 2016, Moody's Analytics stress tested the budget of the 20 most populous states, and it gave many of these states high marks for their ability to handle a recession due to their strong reserves and spending flexibility and their ability to monitor revenue volatility. And that's part of what I'm hoping we will accomplish with a stress test. Utah's able to make adjustments due to its rigorous application of budget stress testing. What I would like to know is does Oregon have adequate reserves? Do we have adequate revenue volatility standards in place? Do we have spending flexibility? Are we prepared for not just a rainy day, but perhaps for a stormy year or two? Now, again, colleagues, I want you to understand, this is introduced in a bipartisan manner. In 2009, I cast a yes vote for additional revenue on high-income Oregonians because I believed we needed that revenue. And so I really, again, want to reiterate, this bill is not introduced as a Republican bill, but as a good government bill where we'd all be able to get information and be able to know what's before us. I'm not sure I have much more to add to that other than I would hope that we could get strong consideration on this and perhaps send it to a work session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Smith? Yes, Representative Eula, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Representative Smith, I think this is a great idea. What happens if they don't do it?
Well, excellent question.
Because we have plenty, I've come to learn over the last 2 years, we have plenty of directives like this to major agencies that they just choose to ignore.
Yeah, that's actually correct. Actually, down in the legislative fiscal office, there's a handful of legislative mandates that get honored on a sporadic basis, and so that would be a concern. I'm not sure I have a mechanism to deal with that, but perhaps this would be a first step for us to at least try to move down a path of garnering this information. But that's a point well taken. I see that all the time in legislative fiscal.
Mm-hmm. Now, this process that you're described in this bill is already done, at least informally, in the budget process, and I know it's done in the revenue process as well. I think what's different about this bill isn't a process so much as it is a more formal report. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, what I envisioned was exactly that in our current environment, you, co-chair Nathanson, the Senate co-chair, the Senate revenue committee would come together, bring all this information together, and be able to present it to the entire body. And again, that way we all have the same information, and as we're trying to deal with these budget scenarios and revenue scenarios, we're all looking at the same information.
Now, the bill has a subsequent to Ways and Means. Somebody thinks this is going to cost some money.
Potentially. Potentially.
Any ideas?
You know, I have not had an opportunity to visit with Mr. Rocco or with the co-chairs, but that would be my next step.
Okay. So if the committee thinks that having a formal report rather than the informal process we use now would be a good thing, then it ought to send the bill on to Ways and Means.
I believe so.
Okay.
Please.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Smith? No one else has signed up. So this is an inside baseball, but that doesn't mean that it isn't important inside baseball.
No, I believe so. I would share with the committee, I've had an opportunity to oversee the Department of Administrative Services budget for the last 6 years, and they're already doing much of this work as well. Again, Mr. Chair, it's an opportunity to coordinate and to provide this information to all members in a formal report, again, so we're all on the same page.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Marsh.
Yeah, before you leave, could you just give me a little bit more information about the timeline that would be applied here? So the report would be submitted in the last quarter of the even numbered year, so right before we're putting together the biennium budget.
That's correct.
And would the report look at the next 2 years, and at what point would you anticipate that the report starts to be constructed? That is, how far in advance of that of its submission?
Excellent question. Mr. Chair and Representative Marsh, I would actually leave those details to the chairs of the committees on how best they feel that information needs to proceed forward. Again, what I'm trying to share with this committee is this information's out there. It's just not collected and put together in one location where we all collectively can have that information. And so I would defer to the chairs of those committees, to the co-chairs of Ways and Means, to our professional staff, and how they think best to proceed.
Okay. So if I understand it right, this would come to us at the same time as the OEA report, the quarterly estimates.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
The governor's budget would coincide.
And the governor's budget comes out at the same time,
exactly.
Of course, or within a few days. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Is that helpful? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3291 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3171. Mm-hmm. Great. Oh.
Would this be all right, Mr. Chair, if I...
Stay right there. Kyle's going to give us a little overview, and then you can tell us what this bill does.
afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3171, there's a dash one amendment, so I'll go through the introduced version and then hit on the amendment real quickly. It would modify conditions under which non-exclusive farm use zone farmland is disqualified from special assessment, and it would modify it to include the termination of a lease between a public owner of the farmland and the taxable lessee. It would clarify instances when the additional taxes are not imposed upon property disqualified from special assessment. So it did include in the background material of the SMS upon disqualification from special assessment, whether it's farmland, forest land, or some others, there's generally back taxes that are owed in either 5 or 10 years. The measure does include some clarification language that's tying the statute together, and it would apply to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2012. It does include, it does allow for a refund of previous paid taxes or abatement of tax liability if those previous taxes were not paid. And it does specify the application of fee requirements to get that refund going back to the years of July 1st, 2012 forward. The dash one would eliminate that retroactive portions of the measure and the associated refund and abatement portions as well.
All right. Now, having heard the technicals, let's find out why we want to do this.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Greg Smith. I'm the State Representative of District 57, which represents Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman, and Wasco County. Colleagues, I want to be very transparent very quickly. Professionally, I do economic development for a living. The Port of Morrow is the second largest port authority in the state of Oregon, and I do have professional relationships with the port as Gary serves as a board member on other entities that I serve on. So I just want to be very clear on that and be very transparent. Mr. Chair, if it'd be all right, what I'd like is for Mr. Dale to just take a moment and walk through the particulars of exactly what this bill does. And then if it would be all right to have Mr. Neal, the general manager of the Port of Morrow, take a moment and share with you the urgency of this legislation.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. Please go ahead.
Alan Dale, senior deputy legislative counsel. And this bill is in response to a Oregon tax court case. The situation was that the Port of Morrow had it owned property. It was leased to a taxable entity that applied for special assessment for the land. And so, ordinarily, as Kyle said, that ordinarily when land that is receiving special assessment is disqualified from it, there are additional taxes that are owed for 5 or 10 years, depending on the program. But there is an exception to that, and the one that applies in this case, it's in 308A709, and that is on the first page. That's section one amended there. If you look in lines 18 through 20, it's public property that was leased or rented to a taxable owner at the time of disqualification from the special assessment program. And the reason for the disqualification was the termination of the lease. So that is the situation that happened. However, the trick that the court case brought forward is that there are actually two time conditions in this statute. So there's one in lines 18 and 19 within this specific set of circumstances at the time of disqualification. So the lease was terminated maybe August 2nd or 7th, somewhere in early August, and they sent notice to the assessor. And then a couple days later, the land was sold by the port, which had possession again, to a taxable owner. So at the time of disqualification, it was property that was leased or rented to a taxable owner, and the reason for the disqualification was termination of the lease. However, if you look back up at lines 8 and 9, there's another condition having to do with timing that applies to the entire statute, not just subsection 5, current subsection 5. It says, as of the date the disqualification is taken into account on the assessment and tax roll. And there is a statute that specifies that if land is disqualified from special assessment on or after July 1st, the disqualification is taken into account on January 1st, the following assessment year. So what happened is that they met the timing condition in subsection 5, but not the overall timing condition that applies to the whole statute. And these two timing conditions are, I mean, they conflict, basically, and set up a situation where the port became responsible for additional taxes because they sold the property right away rather than waiting 5 months and selling it on January 2nd. And so that's the situation. And basically the way the mechanism of the bill is to take subsection 5 out and put it in its own subsection 2, which is on page 2, lines 5 to 7, so that it isn't subject to the two timing conditions which conflict with each other. None of the other six situations have that internal timing condition that conflicts with the general timing condition. So it's just a question of sort of slipping it out from under the one condition and having it just conditioned on the timing internal to itself. Okay. And that's the story.
Okay, just to make certain I understand the technicals before we get on to the other part of the discussion, I think what you've just said, let me put it in different language, is that for most of the bill, this thing that is now labeled sub 1 requires that the date of the disqualification is taken into account on the assessment and tax roll. What you want to do is take that language out, and for the purpose of this particular piece, and the way you've done that is building a section 2 that doesn't contain that language.
Exactly.
Is that a fair way of saying what you just said?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, yes.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hear from the manager, and then we'll ask more questions.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Smith, my name is Gary Neal.
Leave the mic a little further away, and it'll distort less.
Okay.
Thank you. That's good.
My name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Marl. And as it relates to our situation, the properties that we're talking about are, we have large industrial tracts of property, and we also, the port also does what we call land application through our DEQ permits, because we take care of all the process water from our industries as well as deliver that water on for our utility services. And so what we do is while we're not using that property for industrial purposes, we're using it for land application purposes, and we have a farmer that actually does the farming activities, because we take the nutrients in our process waste stream, apply it according to our DEQ permit. And so I have an agreement with our farmer that we take that property out of that type of use and allows us to market and promote our industrial properties as an industrial use. So we take it from a farm activity that helps us in our land application, and we then create an opportunity for economic development, and quite frankly, the valuation increases substantially to an industrial valuation and creates jobs and capital investment that's put on the tax rolls in that event. Because of the timing of the situation, it almost puts us our hands tied to where, if we're doing land application on that property, we can only transact economic opportunities 6 months out of the year. And we thought we were under a situation to where the process was not going to catch us in this requirement to, and the penalty is the industrial value for a 5-year period previous. So it's a substantial implications for that to occur. So it really ties our hands on being able to accomplish what we think are the best way to utilize the properties. It gets some farm use, it gets some value on the property, or otherwise it would sit exempt and no use until we did actually have an industrial activity. So this helps us, and I know we've been working with the assessor and others, Representative Smith and LC and everyone, to try to come up with the appropriate language to accommodate this. And so, but it's needed from where we sit. Otherwise, we're going to be forced into basically putting this property idle and not use it until we have an actual industrial customer to accomplish it because of the consequences.
If
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, originally the bill was written with a retroactive piece of language. What we ended up doing is having a conversation with folks in Morrow County who would be directly impacted by this and recognize that it would be in everyone's best interest to remove that out and not to ask the small little library district to pay back the dollars as a result of this housekeeping bill. And so I hope the committee will view this as a housekeeping piece of legislation in which the port's trying to do the right thing in its economic development activities without necessarily hurting those small little special districts who would have been impacted through the retroactive piece of legislation.
Okay, questions? If I read this correctly, what you're basically saying is that Dash 1 replaces the bold language on the last page, and that removes this retroactive effect that you're talking about.
That's correct.
It would apply prospectively, and what I think you're saying is that we may need to use this mechanism another time, and we don't want to be stuck with having to do it only during those 6 months that are magic and leave away the other 6 months that are not magic.
That is correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All right. Other questions for this panel? I think the assessors have signed up to talk today, too, so we'll hear from them as well. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
And I should say thank you very much for traveling all this way. Representative Smith has to do it anyway, but you don't normally.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I've been working with the Morrow County Assessor to try and get some language that will keep this from happening again, because he agrees that they were trying to do the right thing. Assessors don't have an issue with this, but we do have a slight wording change, and that's why I kept Mr. Dale here to help clarify even further how he has separated this out. And the wording would be in that section 2, mm-hmm. where it says at the time of disqualification, we ask that it be changed to at the time the event that triggers the disqualification. The event that triggers the disqualification would have been the notice that the land is no longer being farmed, even though we don't disqualify it until months later. So this way, at that time, the property is still owned by that public entity, and we wouldn't have this situation that we have now.
Thank you, sir.
And the Morrow County Assessor has seen this, and he is agreeable to the language. He believes this would solve that.
Thank
so
you.
I wanted to come, and instead of testifying against something, I wanted to help something get done, because I always come and testify against things. So
I think it's safe to say that we don't want to prevent the port from being able to transact business during 6 months of the year.
No, we don't. And yeah. They're trying to use their land productively, too. So,
yeah. So are you planning to work with LC to get an additional amendment drafted to accomplish these, or at least have them look at it to see if it's needed?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mr. Dale has looked at it. He believes that it does help clarify for all 36 counties, if this situation happened in other counties, that it helps us to understand the process better.
Okay, thank you. So, Representative Smith, will you work with them? And
I will, Mr.
Chair. Get us another amendment that takes care of this ambiguity.
Yes, sir.
I noticed that language myself, but I wasn't going to make that challenge.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else for this panel? These are the last people to testify on this bill. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, and please work with Representative Smith to get that amendment drafted. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3171. Colleagues, we have a full agenda tomorrow. Now that we've moved the forest products tax issues over till tomorrow. Part of that's a scheduling issue for other people. We also have a bunch of work sessions. Let me tell you briefly, what I'm hoping we do tomorrow is that in addition to the hearings on 2270 and 2466, we also have a conversation on during the work session on the property tax exemption sunset bill with the Dash 1 amendment, because when in our public hearing, we only heard from the housing group and the farm and forest group of people. We didn't hear from anybody else. And I'm interested in understanding the committee's appetite for the rest of the bill. And so we'll have the Dash 1 to look at. Whether we get to the other work sessions tomorrow, I don't know. It's a matter of timing, how much time there is. But if you come prepared, we might. If not, we'll have to carry those over as well. I just thought I'd let you know, because the agenda is being moved around a bunch, what I'm thinking about. And I don't expect, unless something unusual happens, to actually move the property tax exemption sunset bill tomorrow, unless the committee is absolutely ready. But I would like to have a conversation so we know what further work or public hearings we ought to hold. Anything else? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Oh, yes, sorry. Representative Johnson.
So on that bill, it's 2859, right?
I'm not sure.
Yes.
They're saying yes.
Dash 2 amendments?
Is that what it is?
That's what I see up.
Yeah, it's the amendment that removes farm and forest, natural resources, and the exemptions that already have sunsets. And what's left is the part I want to talk about, and be prepared to discuss tomorrow. All right. Anything else? Thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.